I'll call the meeting to order. And while we are awaiting quorum, I think we'll just begin by hearing the testimony on Representative Sanders' bill. So we'll begin that, and we'll officially move that once we get quorum. So if you'd like to proceed, please do.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate that. My name is Representative Tim Sanders, and today I bring before the committee a bill that expands the veterans' preference for hunting license lottery drawings to Purple Heart recipients and veterans who are at least 70% disabled. Have with me today Mr. Ray Lopresto, who would like to also give a brief background as well on that.
Thank you. Would you like to identify yourself for the record?
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chairman, committee members, my name is Ray Lopresto. I'm from rural Cannon Falls area. In 2004, a number of graduates of West Point, class of 1958, started a mentor program to help the severely wounded soldiers returning from Afghanistan and Iraq. And they found a tremendous need. It expanded, and in last year, they decided they needed a follow-on mentor program for the soldiers who were being released from Walter Reed and going back to their home state. And through the Association of Graduates, I'm a 1962 graduate of West Point, I saw this need, and I volunteered to be a follow-on mentor, they call it. I was almost immediately assigned a wounded warrior from North Branch. I met Justin. We instantly bonded. Besides the military bond, we had a bond of outdoor issues that we enjoyed so much. I had him down to our place in rural Cannon Falls, our farm, just to be able to meet with him and for him to build some trust. Mama Lopresto gave him the lasagna, and I took him out into the woods just to see how mobile he was. I have a fairly good population of turkeys, and he was mobile enough where I thought I could take him hunting. And so I asked him if he would be interested in going turkey hunting this spring with me, and his eyes lit up. So we went into the process to try and make sure that he would get a permit, because it is a lottery system. And when I investigated the situation, I found out about the preference program for veterans. The preference program mentions that you had to be have service within the last 24 months. And when I saw that, knowing the intimate details of his disabilities and his wounds and everything, I thought that should be, for these severely wounded people, should be a lifetime preference. And I did as much research as I could, and I sent an email to my representative, and that's how this bill got started.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Actually, we have a quorum now, so I will have you move the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With great pleasure, I'd like to move a House file 289. Is it to be recommended to pass and be moved somewhere? Or
Representative Wagner, it's to be heard and laid over for possible inclusion.
Well, I hope we include it. I'll move the bill for possible inclusion.
Okay. Are there any additional questions or any questions at all? Representative Thiel.
What are the exclusions on the bill? What game animals? I don't have the bill in front of me. Are moose excluded in the bill on the moose lottery?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, that is correct. Moose, elk of prairie chicken are also excluded.
Thank you.
Representative Hackler.
Madam Chair, and maybe this should be directed to Representative Dill, I'm not sure, or the Committee Administrator, Kirk. I know that there's some other bills that have to do with hunting and fishing licenses, those kinds of things that are also connected to the military service. Are we hearing all those bills in this committee and then holding them over for possible inclusion in a game and fish bill? or have we checked it out to see if the Veterans Affairs Committee needs to see those bills?
Representative Hackbosch, in the past, apparently Veterans Services has not asked for that, but the committee administrator will check it out.
Okay, because I know there's some other bills similar that have to do with the same topic, and I believe in the past some of those bills have gone to Veterans Affairs Committee and been sent here. So that might be something we might want to check out in case there's a problem.
Thank you. Well, if there are no further questions or concerns, well, I'll just say that House File 289 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
At this time, we'll ask for testimony or presentation, rather, from the DNR regarding moose management, the research plan and progress report.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources, and I'll let the person with me introduce himself.
Madam Chair, members, Grant Wilson. I work with the Division of Fish and Wildlife as a policy planning coordinator for the DNR.
And Madam Chair, I thought we have a series of reports here, and I've asked staff that works with the various reports to help with the presentation. So the first one is actually a progress report that was required, and just to set a little background, then I'll let Mr. Wilson talk about the process that we're using to do the report. But I think the committee is generally aware that Minnesota moose populations are not faring very well. The Northwest, we have or had two kind of distinct, we call them disjunct populations of moose in the state, one in northwestern Minnesota, one in northeastern Minnesota. Moose in Minnesota occur at the southern periphery of their range. They're primarily a northern kind of boreal species. And the northwest Minnesota population actually went through a long-term decline and is very close to not being present anymore. And that occurred over the last 25 years or so. And we stopped hunting moose in northwestern Minnesota back in the mid-1990s as that population was, there were still several thousand animals, but they were in a declining mode. There was a large research project, cooperative research project done with university and federal biologists, and actually a monograph of that research has been published, and there were a number of implications for that decline that were related to low pregnancy rates and high parasite loads and all that, but one common factor seemed to be animals under stress, and there was strong indications that warmer temperatures were causing stress during the course of the time that that study looked at, whether it's climate change or variation over the time period. We can't say for certain, but moose are large black animals that have difficulty regulating their body temperature. So that population hadn't been hunted for 10 years or so. The northeast population continues to do fairly well and continues to be hunted, although we've gotten to bolt-only seasons the last couple of years. Last legislative session, there was interest in doing something, and there was a bill. I don't think there was anything in this body, but in the Senate there was a bill that would have required designation of a biologist for moose in northwestern Minnesota and that sort of thing. And we worked with the author and with the conference committee that Representative Dill was on crafting the language that's in this report that requires a more comprehensive look at what we may or may not be able to do about moose, and required a progress report back to the legislature in January, and that progress report and an update on where we're at since January, now that we're in February, is what we're here to talk about today. So I'll just have Mr. Wilson talk about, we're in the middle of the planning process that was mandated. I'll just point out that we have the legislation quoted in here that required the DNR to consult with research scientists, wildlife managers, tribal interests, other agencies with moose research and management expertise, and other key stakeholder groups on the development of a moose management research plan for Minnesota. So we're in the midst of that process, and I'll ask Mr. Wilson just to give the committee a few minutes on how we're going about doing that.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, we began the process by getting together an ad hoc steering committee that laid out a process of participation with the types of folks that Mr. Boggs mentioned, other stakeholders, other biology agencies, and tribal interests and others, and laid out a process of forming a moose advisory committee that would create recommendations to the DNR on management and research for the future of that species. The process began with meeting with identification of members, which are noted on page 5. Moose Advisory Committee members are noted on page 5 along with position and affiliation. Those, again, were identified by members of that ad hoc group as folks who were either intimately knowledgeable about moose biology or had a vested stake in the population in the state. The Moose Advisory Committee, who is chaired by Dr. Rolf Peterson, who is a noted wolf and moose researcher from Northern Michigan, has had three meetings thus far. The second of those meetings coincided in December with a Minnesota Moose Summit, which was a one-day event held in Duluth that gathered other moose researchers and experts from around North America to essentially provide thoughts, advice, and report on the state of moose in other parts of the continent for dissemination used by the Moose Advisory Committee. The committee will meet a total of 7 times. They began their first meeting in September 2008. Their final meeting will be in June 2009. They will make recommendations to the DNR in June, and the DNR then will begin the process of writing a management research plan for moose. The process of within the Moose Advisory Committee has been formed to form subcommittee areas, which are creating draft recommendations, and will then have those vetted in full committee process. That is essentially where we're at today. I'm happy to answer questions.
Are there any questions from members? If not, thank you for bringing us up to date on this, and we'll move along to the future of wild turkey hunting. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gill.
I do have a question for Mr. Boggess on that moose. As the, I'm trying to remember from the report, as the incidence of auto collisions and has that non-hunting increased or decreased? A moose died this weekend up by my house because of it, and I just brought it to my mind that I'm wondering, are they getting on the road with the population somewhat declining? Are they getting on the road more or less?
Mr. Bowdy.
Madam Chair and Representative Bill, it's a good question. I don't know what the roadkill statistics are, but I do know that moose When there are deep snows, they have a tendency to find railroad tracks and roads where it's easier to walk, and that usually ends up in a bad outcome for the moose when that happens. So I know there's a lot of snow this winter. Also, they are under some kind of stress, which our research project in the Northeast has been indicating a lot of unexplained mortality that appears to be stress-related, that they may be more prone to seek out places where they can get around more easily. But I don't know the numbers on roadkill moose for this winter.
And one more question.
Yeah.
How about, has subsistence hunting increased or decreased?
Mr. Bond.
Madam Chair and Representative Bill, the moose population is surveyed every year. In fact, we just completed the aerial survey last week, and then we calculate a harvestable surplus and meet with the three bands that have moose harvest rights in the Northeast, the Fond du Lac, Grand Portage, and Boy Fort. Grand Portage and Boy Fort are limited by an agreement, a 1988 agreement that was ratified by the legislature, to no more than 30 moose a year. So theirs has not changed. Fond du Lac, it pulled out of that agreement a year after it was ratified, which was any party could opt out. And they've since been managing their own moose harvest, but they've been pretty constantly in the range of about 40 moose per year. So I would say the subsistence, if you mean by that, the harvest by the bands, has pretty much stayed stable.
One more follow-up. Do they handle that internally on a lottery or something for their members? Is that how they do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, it's up to them how they determine who gets to take how many moose. The state has, you know, some negotiation, say, excuse me, in terms of how many total, but they decide how to divide it up amongst themselves.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? If not, we'll move on to the...
Madam Chair, I'll again make a few introductory remarks and then turn this over to Mr. Pinning, who worked on this report, also the next one on your list on disabilities. But this report, recommendations for future wild turkey hunting management, was something that I think Representative Hansen had initially authored a year ago. As he pointed out at the time, we've had turkey hunting in Minnesota for about 30 years now, and it's been kind of a piecemeal process. Turkeys, wild turkeys were native to Minnesota, the southern part of the state originally, but had been extirpated prior to settlement. There were some attempts to reintroduce them, and I don't want to steal too much of Mr. Penning's thunder here, but there were some attempts to reintroduce wild turkeys that didn't succeed too well until we began stocking wild trapped eastern strain birds that were the native strain to Minnesota. At that point, the population pretty much started to explode and expand, and we've continued the trap and transplant program since that time, although we're now in the process of pretty much wrapping up putting turkeys anywhere that we think are suitable habitat in the state. So, but as a result of that growing population and expanding population, we added hunting areas kind of piecemeal over that time. We eventually began to allow some hunting in the fall. Turkey hunting is traditionally done in the spring when the birds can be called and the harvest can be focused on the gobblers only, and the hens, which are nesting at that time, are off limits, and it really has no population impact. That's kind of the traditional turkey hunting, but there's also fall hunting, which is more flocks, family flocks, the birds that it's either sex, the hens or the gobblers are legal in the fall. And we started adding some fall areas, but not very many, and we had a bill before you a year ago that actually passed that set up a special season just for the metro range. I think that was part of what prompted this suggestion, which now is a law, that the department do a more comprehensive report on the kind of the history of turkey hunting and where we see it going in the future. And so the law that this report was produced under just simply required that the Commissioner of Natural Resources, in consultation with the National Wild Turkey Federation, provide the legislature with recommendations for future management of hunting wild turkeys in Minnesota. I think the idea was not to encourage piecemealing these seasons, either legislatively or through our own processes. And we thought it made a lot of sense, too. So we did work with the Turkey Federation, and we have produced this report. And with that, I'll let Mr. Penning walk you through the report.
Thank you. Mr. Penning, welcome to committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Penning. I'm the Farmland Wildlife Program Leader with the Department of Natural Resources, and one of the things that I do is coordinate the turkey program. For a little bit of historical background, wild turkeys are native to extreme southern Minnesota. However, they were extirpated sometime in the 1880s, and we really did not have any turkeys at all in Minnesota for many years. There were attempts to release pen-raised birds, and there were attempts to release Merriam's turkeys, which is a subspecies of the turkey that did not normally occur here. We have the eastern wild turkey. All of those attempts failed until the ability to trap and move wild birds was figured out in the 1960s. In 1971 and 1973, the first releases were done in Minnesota in Houston County of wild-caught eastern birds, and those were quite successful. We've brought in birds from Missouri, New York, Illinois, and other states, and we've also moved thousands of birds internally in Minnesota. We opened up our first hunting season in 1978 with 420 permits available. As of 2009, this year we have 42,328 permits available, and we have 73 permit areas that are open to hunting. Habitat management, research in the trap and transplant program, as well as cooperation between the DNR, the National Wild Turkey Federation, and other sporting organizations has provided a healthy wild turkey population and excellent turkey hunting opportunities in Minnesota. To give you some background on how we make our decisions on when we open permit areas and how we establish permit numbers, we use for the spring, we have a model that we use, a mathematical model, and two of our generally most important things that we incorporate into that model are turkey population estimates and hunt quality indicators. Our 2006 long-range plan for the management of turkeys in Minnesota states that our current goal is for hunter success to exceed 20% and for interference rates to be below 40%. Another thing that we do is we survey our spring turkey hunters. Once every 2 years, we survey one-third of the state. We ask them questions about are they satisfied with their hunt, things relating to ease of access to hunting land, feelings of safety, lack of interference from other hunters, observing turkeys while hunting, and having the opportunity to get a shot and successfully harvesting a turkey. Based on the results of our spring surveys, turkey hunters are experiencing a quality hunt characterized generally by high success, low interference, and good access to hunting land. To estimate the turkey population range expansion, we use a male survey of deer hunters that we conduct every 2 years. We ask deer hunters to report the location that they're hunting, if they see turkeys and how many. And we then plot those sightings and use that to estimate turkey range expansion. Currently, we have 73 permit areas open with 8 time periods and a quota system. So you need to apply for one of the 8 time periods. You can take a second choice if you care to do that within one of the 73 open permit areas. The drawing then is we do use a system of preference. Your preference is determined by the number of years in which you have an unsuccessful application, the more preference points that you have, the higher up you are on the list for being drawn the next year. The goal of our system is to provide turkey quality turkey hunting opportunities by distributing our hunters in both time and space, and make sure that we can sustain a harvest. We have five types of licenses that are available to spring turkey hunters. We have a general lottery license, which I just described. We have landowner permits, in which we allocate up to 20% of permits for each permit area and time period that are reserved for landowners. We have surplus permits. So at the end of each season, we have some permits which were not drawn. We make those available first to unsuccessful applicants, and then after that, we make them. We open it up to the general public. We also have an over-the-counter archery permit, which can be purchased and used during the last two time periods of the eight in permit areas with 50 or more permits per time period. And we have military permits, which are available for those on active military status. For our fall hunt, we have 2 5-day periods, and with currently we have 50 permit areas open. Additionally, permit area 601, which is the vast majority of the Twin Cities area, has a single 30-day time period. This was something new that we instituted in the fall of 2008. Our turkey management in Minnesota is in a state of change. The turkey populations are moving from the establishment phase to stable populations, particularly in the southeast. So we've reached a carrying capacity, if you will, and the population will wobble around a certain number based upon weather conditions primarily. As turkey populations reach stability, our management priorities and strategies are changing. We're moving from very conservative management strategies that allow the population to expand to strategies that maximize turkey hunting opportunities, and we're trying to minimize regulatory complexity while still sustaining healthy turkey populations. So what I'd like to do next is talk about some of the future directions that we're looking at going, one of which is to consolidate our permit areas. Right now, our permit areas follow the deer permit areas. We have 73 open for spring turkey hunting. I think that made a lot of sense when we were in our conservative management phase, because they're small and they're easier to regulate. Now that, particularly in the southeast where we have abundant turkeys, I think that we could probably start aggregating a number of these permit areas, maybe 5 or 10 at a time, into much larger permit areas. So that gives people a little bit more opportunity to move around, reduces the number of permit areas, which reduces complexity both for the hunter and for us administratively. We're also, our ultimate goal would be to offer spring over-the-counter turkey licenses to everyone who wants to hunt. We're not quite there yet because our supply of turkeys does not meet the demand, in that we have about 40,000 permits and in excess of 50,000 people that are applying for them. However, many of those people are applying for the early season permits, which is why they don't get drawn, and they may have to wait a couple, 3 years. Generally, later seasons, like the G, H, and F seasons, have surplus permits. And so what we're proposing to do is to go to over-the-counter sales for the last two time periods in permit areas that reach a certain threshold of permits per time period, and it'll probably be 25 or 50. We're debating that because we use both of those numbers for other things right now. We're trying to make sure that we're consistent there. Right now, because fall turkey hunting is not particularly popular in Minnesota, as in most states, we actually exceed our demand with our supply of permits right now. So we will likely be moving within the next few years to discontinue the fall lottery and go to a system of over-the-counter fall turkey permits. However, I would like to note that fall turkey hunting is an either-sex hunt, and it has the greatest potential to affect populations because hens are killed in the fall. And at this time, we have a very strong turkey population, and there's really no reason why we can't move to a fall over-the-counter hunt. However, should we find ourselves in a situation with declining turkey populations like a run of bad spring so that we have poor reproduction, we may have to regain some control over that and move away from over-the-counter sales or limit the numbers somehow. Registration, the DNR is currently overhauling our electronic licensing system. In the past, you've had to register each turkey that you've shot by driving to a registration station where it's registered on the ELS system. Starting for the spring of 2010, we'll be able to do telephone registrations for turkeys. So once you bag your bird, you can simply call on your phone and register your bird that way. We'll still continue that to require that hunters sight tag their turkeys at the time of harvest, just like you do with deer. We're trying to promote youth hunting, and with turkeys we're looking at for the spring of 2010, we'll allow youth 17 years and younger to purchase a spring turkey license over the counter from any DNR license vendor for any season after the C season in permit areas that have 25 permits or more per season. We think that that will make it quite a bit easier for kids to get permits while still not sending lots of kids to permit areas that have very few permits because there are few turkeys. Additionally, the cost of a youth permit was reduced to half beginning this year. I'm going to talk about disabled hunts in a separate report, so I'll defer that for now. The use of dogs currently is illegal in Minnesota. That is an artifact of being conservative. Many states allow the use of dogs for fall turkey hunting in Minnesota, and we don't see any reason why we should not allow that in Minnesota. In fact, we think that there perhaps are some benefits for allowing that. For instance, right now, a hunter who happens to have a valid turkey permit but may be out pheasant hunting with his dog, if a turkey gets up and he shoots it, that's a violation because he has his dog with it. And we would just as soon not put hunters in that situation. So we are proposing to revise Minnesota Rule 6236-0700 to allow the use of dogs for fall turkey hunting only. Problem turkeys. In certain circumstances, wild turkeys generate conflicts with humans. During the breeding season, turkeys can become somewhat aggressive towards people, especially in areas that they're not hunted. Turkeys can also concentrate around areas of food, such as feedlots or silage, during harsh winter weather conditions. Many problem birds come from domesticated wild turkeys that are illegally released by well-intending members of the public. We distinguish between nuisance and depredation birds. Nuisance turkeys are birds that are in the areas where there's little or no hunting pressure, and turkeys can sometimes become aggressive and a bit of a nuisance. You've probably seen reports on television about, you know, the turkey that occasionally chases the mailman or something like that. We do get calls on those. It's our position that the best and most effective solution to nuisance turkeys is through hunting. However, we realize that oftentimes in these areas, opportunities are limited due to either access to land or firearms discharge restrictions. However, we don't want to be one of the restrictive factors in that, so we have started experimenting with what we're calling a 600 series of permits based on the changes that we made to 601 last year. Where rather than having 2 5-day hunting periods, we had a 30-day hunting period, and we also raised the quota of permits so high that it was essentially unlimited. Anybody who applied for a permit was selected.
At this point, we have a question from Representative Dill.
So we're going to continue looking at ways that we can address nuisance turkeys in the urban areas and suburban areas through hunting where appropriate, and we would encourage cities to allow some hunting even if it's only archery hunting in areas where there's issues. Depredating turkeys tend to show up during harsh winters when the snow is deep. These are the birds that congregate in large flocks near food resources. Oftentimes they'll get into feedlots, silage piles. Sometimes they'll even come right into barns. And this, of course, can cause some conflicts with the farmers who are hosting the birds. We have in the past tried a variety of procedures to discourage these turkeys. However, currently, under conditions that include a very healthy and expanding turkey population, along with declining human and financial resources, we are going to be revising our guidelines to move more quickly towards the issuance of shooting permits. So rather than an area manager having to go through a very prescribed stepwise process before getting to issuing a shooting permit at his discretion, his or her discretion, the area manager would be able to issue a permit rather quickly. That's it for my report. I'll take any questions.
Representative Deal.
Thank you. On the 601, where there are firearms discharge restrictions, do they also have restrictions against the use of bow and arrow and crossbow? Or are there some that do and some that don't? How does that work out when it comes to the turkey hunt?
Mr. Penning.
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, in my experience in working in the metro area, typically any city, they all can be different, but typically any city that has a firearms discharge ordinance defines that quite broadly. They include bow and arrows, crossbows, and some of them even get down to including paintball guns and stuff like that. So they tend to be extremely restrictive.
Representative Dale.
And then kind of generalize for me, how much of 601 has got the restrictions as a percentage? 5, 10, 15, 40%? Got an idea?
Madam
Chair,
Penning. Representative Dale, I would say that the vast majority, I would say that probably close to maybe 80 or 90% of the municipalities have some sort of a discharge ordinance. However, it sometimes does not cover the entire city. For instance, I live in Lakeville, and I would say that 95% of the city of Lakeville is close to hunting and close to the discharge of firearms. 5% of it is open to hunting, because that tends to be the more rural areas that are still available for that.
Just one last follow-up, please, Andrew.
Yeah, Representative Gill.
So how does that play into the management in 601? Because we made 601 the way it is because of the turkey population. How's that, all those restrictions work towards the balancing of the population versus the person population?
Mr. Penning.
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, the firearm, from a wildlife management standpoint, a firearms discharge ordinances make it very difficult to deal with something like nuisance turkeys or nuisance deer. It makes it tough. I mean, you need to have some of those sorts of ordinances, but you know, when you get turkeys on Main Street, it makes it pretty tough to do something about it.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Penning, the recommendations you make, the department's planning on dealing with those through rules, or do you need any statutory changes to make those?
Mr. Penning.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I believe that we can do these changes through rule. A lot of this we do. A fair amount of this we do through our expedited rule process, where we set permit areas and seasons and numbers every year. So those are quite easy. Some of these other ones are in permanent rule, and we'll have to go through the permanent rule process to change that. For instance, allowing the use of dogs.
Representative Hansen.
Just to follow up, so your annual, when you go out with the stakeholders and have the meetings and you make the tweaks to the licenses, you can do that relating to these changes, with the exception of the dog assistance.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, yeah, I believe that we can for most of these. I'll need to go back and look at the exact process on some of the stuff, but most of this is related to the season setting and process.
Representative Hansen.
Okay, and then I have a question on your chart on the page 11 with the fall applications and the in 2008, with the number of applicants and number of permits in the harvest, the jump there, is that really as a function of 601, with having the metro area and essentially anybody de facto over-the-counter purchases? Is that what happened there?
Mr. Penning.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we did double our harvest in 601. We went from about 25 birds to 50 birds.
Okay.
But we have not quite figured out why the harvest jumped up so dramatically. I suspect... you were questioning the permits? Or the? I'm sorry.
Well, you have permits available, and then the harvest jumped, so you increased permits.
Permits available, the big jump in permits available was due to pushing an extra 1,000 permits in 601. And we have not yet been able to explain why the harvest jumped so significantly, but it's not because of 601.
Representative Hansen.
I have a series of questions that are hopping around, and if somebody else has some. The question, one of the issues that has gone back and forth, which I don't see anything in the report on, is the landowner-tenant question, and we've had legislation on that, I think, back and forth, changing it, proposing changing it, and tied in with that is the delay on applications for the spring permit and then notifying people. Could you maybe just go through, did you talk about that, and then how does that work and changing the timeline or the time lag of verifying landowner-tenant questions?
Mr. Penning.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, it does take time to verify landowners. This year, we gave turkey hunters an extra 5 weeks to apply. We pushed the application, rather than it being due the first Friday in January, we pushed it to the second Friday in February. So they did get an extra 5 weeks. December and January. And in response to that, we now are not checking the landowner list. What we did in the past was we checked the landowner list, and anybody that was caught with an invalid application was rejected without notice. We just tossed them out of the lottery, and they were not eligible to receive a permit. What we have decided to do this year is we are turning it over to our enforcement division for them to deal with however they see fit. Every year we do get some calls by people saying, you know, Fred down the street got a permit, he's not a valid landowner, and I would imagine we're going to start ticketing those people.
Representative Hansen.
I thought one of the other challenges was somebody may list 40 acres, but it's 40 acres of bare ground that doesn't have any turkey habitat on it. I mean, how do you deal with that, Ben?
Mr. Penning.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, what the law says now is that they just have to own 40 acres of land. So I suppose it could be 40 acres of an industrial park. I don't think anybody is doing that. But
Mr. Boggess.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, just to follow up on that a little bit, I think it's that it has to be agricultural or grazing land, but it still doesn't necessarily have to have what we would consider huntable habitat on it. And there was an attempt, and as you say, this has gone back and forth, and there's been different ideas on how to manage this, but a few years ago there was a requirement, I think it passed, to require that, was it in effect for 1 year?
Yes, 1 year.
To require the person who got drawn in, the landowner drawing, to hunt on their own property, thinking that would self-poise itself, because if I have 40 acres of ground, I'm not going to want to have a landowner permit if that's the only place I can hunt. But it was very unpopular, and it was repealed the next year.
Are there any further questions? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Penning or Mr. Boggess, the dogs, did I understand Representative Hansen to say that you need legislative work to get that fixed for the fall, or you can do that by rule?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I believe that we can do that by rule. Minnesota Rule 6236-0700. So it's a permanent rule. It's not part of the expedited rule process,
okay.
But it'll take a couple of years.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would strongly encourage you to do that, I think, for the fall season. I mean, one, the dog is great to have available for the possible retrieve in the case of a lost bird. I personally had that happen in the fall, and the dog was in the truck, and he had to leave the dog in the truck. You know, you feel kind of foolish in the situation. like that. My other thoughts are, do you really think that we're not at a point to, why don't we deal with this landowner deal and just let them have a permit, tell them to buy it over the counter? We'd eliminate that whole mess. I'm really thinking this thing has been such a success, it's unbelievable. I actually saw one last weekend up by Pequot Lake, the second time I've seen it. Man, that thing was in such a deep snow walking along. I mean, they're such a success. I'm wondering if we're not pushing this hard enough. Should some of these late seasons just be over the counter right now? I see you're proposing them in 2010, but I'm wondering if we should even be more aggressive in moving forward. Why couldn't we just let the landowners get a permit? Maybe even they do have to hunt on their own land, but just give them a permit. They don't have to get it. If they want to be part of the drawing, they can be part of the drawing. If they want to hunt their own land, let them have a permit. I wonder how many of them, that would kind of make that go away, wouldn't it?
Mr. Penning. Or Mr. Boggett.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, I think the approach that we're taking now, and this was prompted somewhat by some of the discussion at the roundtable a year ago, and I believe it was Representative Dill had a bill in that didn't come out in the final omnibus bill last year that would have just said, we'll take your application on face value, we'll deal with whether you applied properly or not after the fact. And that's exactly what we're doing this year, and I think it may be a learning experience for the landowners, and I think we would, our enforcement division would take a warning approach the first time to a landowner. But we're no longer holding up the drawing because of the landowner application. We're allowing it to go forward, and then if there are some that look like anomalies, they don't look like they have the acreage, they don't look like they live in the permit area, they'll get a warning. If they persist in attempting to apply, then they'll get a ticket. So I think if we just opened it up to landowners, which I understood was your suggestion, to buy over the counter, I'm not sure quite how we would administer that. We have something like that for deer right now, where if you have 40 acres of agricultural or grazing land, you can get a free bonus tag, but you still have to, and it is over the counter, you still have to allow hunting, but we don't have any way of knowing who those people are in time to let people know. And that's one advantage of the current landowner system, is we can publish the list so that other people then, they have to allow some public hunting, other people then can know who they are to contact them.
I lost my train of thought. Go ahead and answer.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on Representative McNamara's point, all you'd have to do is contact the state of Iowa, because they allow landowners to go to the county courthouse and purchase the license, and if they're the landowner. So I think if you checked with Iowa, unless they've changed it in the last couple of years, there's a landowner. They're still buying a license. They're still paying that, but they could have that access for it. And so maybe something to check in the future on that.
Representative McNamara.
I came back. It was a senior woman. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Boggess, what about my thoughts about are we pushing this hard enough? Is there a reason why we couldn't do push this quicker, these later seasons? Aren't we really at the point to where we can, let everybody just about shoot one that wants to shoot one now?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, we're proposing in the late season to allow that. We kind of have that now because we have leftover permits that are available first come, first serve after a certain date. Some of those never get taken. So, but there you have less flexibility about when you can go and so forth. But we would propose to take it to public input this year. Our 2009 season is already set. So we would propose to take it to public input this year and do it the next season that, hasn't already gone through the process.
Representative Hansen, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. And I agree with you. The one thing, I'm talking about the later seasons. There's no way. Those early seasons, it'd be chaotic. I mean, there's no comparison to in the first week or two. And, I mean, the opportunity there is just really unbelievable that I would think so. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On a different subject, poaching, I'm checking to see if you're seeing any increase in poaching or if you have any way of tracking poaching.
Mr. Penning.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we don't have a very good way of tracking poaching. We hear about it anecdotally sometimes. I even heard about it once when I was sitting in a cafe, not being a DNR guy. But it's tough to do. It's one of those sort of hidden crimes. It's pretty easy to take a turkey and get away with it. So we don't think that it's having a biological impact, but at least on the broad scale, I don't know if it does locally or not. We just can't really wrap our arms around that very well.
Follow-up, Representative Hansen?
Do you have you kept track of any violations of actual catching folks or with enforcement actions on poaching?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that was going to be the point I was going to make, is that our enforcement division does keep statistics of violations, warnings, citations, and we could see if there's, I don't know, there's been an upward trend for wild turkey violations, but we could have them query that database and get back to the committee on that.
And Chair, final question, with the deer hunting, there's been some suggestions about having accelerated penalties based on whether the deer are trophy deer or for compensation or recompensation relating to poaching. Could that, if there's a proposal that's going to be relating to deer, is it possible to do something with turkey as well?
Mr. Boggess.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, it certainly is something that we could look at. I'm trying to remember right now, there is some additional penalty on deer in existing restitution laws or rules. I know the Minnesota Deer Hunters is proposing that we go even further than that, and so I don't know if there's going to be action on that this year or not, but certainly there are things with body weight and beard length and spur length and things like that that turkey hunters keep track of similarly to what deer hunters do, so good luck at that.
Okay, I do have one final question on a little bit different tack, and that is looking back to nuisance turkeys and problems in that area with farmers and with agriculture. I'm thinking of course, the situation with bovine TB and the deer population. Has there been any study or any discussion of possible problems with the wild turkey population, as it may, if they are getting into feed that the turkeys, the captive turkeys, are eating? Either of you.
Madam Chair, in terms of like bovine TB or CWD, typically mammalian diseases are not transmittable to birds.
I know.
We have tested our turkeys every time that we do trap and transplant on our turkeys. So over the years, we've got pretty good blood work on them, and we have never had a major disease outbreak in Minnesota. So we're not particularly worried about it. It's not, even nationwide, it's not a very big issue for turkeys.
Thank you. Yes, I was aware that bovine TB is not likely to occur in turkeys.
Just to follow up, I think that certainly when the turkey program was in its early years, there was some concern with the captive turkey industry, which were, if not the number one, was one of the number one in the country, and I think that was the direction your question was going more. But I think there's interest on both sides in biosecurity and keeping the two from mixing with each other. Mr. Penning said, we haven't found evidence of any real transmissible diseases in the wild birds that would go to the domestic, but I know that there's still a desire on the part of the domestic turkey producers to keep the two separate as much as possible.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions? If not, thank you for your testimony. And we'll move on to your next report.
Madam Chair, just a very brief introduction to this think it was former Representative Heidgerken, this was a floor amendment. He had a constituent who we've also worked with on some special hunts, and we worked with on this report, that was interested in just taking a look at how we do our disability hunting permits and procedures, and it was, the concern was primarily around turkey hunting. So Mr. Penning convened a group to look at this issue, and we have a few modest recommendations that we're following through on that I'll let Mr. Penning walk the committee through.
Thank you. Mr. Penning?
What we were looking at here was changes necessary to simplify disability hunting permits and procedures. So in order to do that, I put together a work group that included some DNR folks, but also included Mr. Ron Welly from Midwest Outdoors Unlimited, Mr. Roger Houck from Capable Partners, Mr. Mike Hansen, who's the president of Capable Partners, and Mr. Eric Linder from the National Wild Turkey Federation. These are all groups that are heavily involved with putting on hunts for disabled hunters. We conduct various hunts for disabled hunters. Of course, my area is turkey, so we conduct a number of turkey disabled hunts every year, typically with the organizations that I just named off. We even did that disabled hunt this year for prairie chickens in 2008. That was the first time we've done that. We also do a number of hunts for deer hunters too. And I'm not really going to focus on deer hunting in this report. The committee felt that things worked just fine with deer hunting and really didn't even want to talk about that at all. But we did convene a work group, and we came up with five issues. So I'll run through the issues, and then I'll run through the solutions that we came up with for those issues. The first one was procedural complexity. Right now, we use expedited rule process for each hunt, and to speed up our rule writing and increase efficiency, all the hunts for a particular species, for example, turkeys, they're bundled together and sent through the required rules process all at the same time. So we just do one package rule, and in fact, typically we package that with our regular spring turkey hunt and sent it all through the rule process at the same time. The result of that was that all turkey hunts needed to be identified by December for April and May hunts. And that's not really an issue for long-term hunts that have been run on a regular schedule, but it is problematic for new hunts that are proposed just before the season opens. It seems like maybe once a year I'll get a call from somebody who wants to do a new hunt, and they're starting to think about this long about January or February, long after the rule has been published. So that's our first issue. The second one is communication. It's been an issue between the DNR and sponsoring nonprofit organizations. The organization's hunt coordinators sometimes change from year to year. They don't always let us know who those are, and it makes it difficult for us to coordinate with them in terms of letting them know what the deadlines are for getting their information in. So we have not always been able to be the most effective and efficient in our communications with the sponsoring nonprofits as we would like to be. Third issue is licensing barriers. Right now, under our old ELS system, which is changing this year, we would have had to reprogram the system for each special hunt, and that cost maybe $5,000 or more a shot. So given that we put on many special hunts in a year, we were not doing that. We were using the old paper licensing system where we would actually have the applicants mail into St. Paul their application, and then we would write them out a paper license. Well, actually, Ron Coleman and the license girl would make them an ELS-type license, but he'd have to do it by hand, and then we'd mail it back to them. that's fairly inefficient. And oftentimes we had a couple of issues. One, hunters would wait too long before they applied, and we weren't able to turn it around in time. Or two, they'd actually go down to the ELS station to buy their license, and they weren't able to do it. The fourth one was a lack of understanding regarding disabled hunts and private lands. There's a common misconception that, that disabled hunts cannot take place on private land. In fact, these hunts are specifically authorized in statute. The fifth one is barriers to obtaining a permit to discharge a firearm from a motor vehicle. Disabled hunters often need to hunt from a standing motor vehicle. Current statute defines three criteria that the department uses to issue a permit for disabled hunters shooting from a motor vehicle. Part 2B of that requires that the applicant must possess a valid disability parking certificate before we can issue him or her the permit. This is provision has been a barrier for some disabled hunters who do not own or drive an automobile or even have a driver's license, but they still have the opportunity to hunt from a standing motor vehicle because somebody drives them out there and sets them up, which is what capable partners like to do if it's particularly cold. Or some of these folks that don't drive cars can drive an ATV, and they want to drive their ATV out and actually sit on the ATV, particularly with turkey hunting. They just build a blind right over it. And if they're sitting on the ATV, they need a permit for that. Those are our five issues. Our proposed changes for procedural complexity, we decided that this is as much of a communications issue as a rulemaking issue. And I'll talk about communications in a minute. But what we are going to do is we're going to de-link, and we've already done it this year, we're going to de-link our disabled hunts from the spring turkey rule, which will then give us more time. So we're going to do a standalone disabled hunt expedited rule, which we can put off until probably January or February, rather than having to get that done in December as we do now. So we've bought some more time. We're going to work on our communications. In terms of communications, we're going to begin publishing information on our website outlining the procedures and criteria required for nonprofit organizations to hold a disabled hunt. So those folks can go out and find it on their own. We don't have to figure out who the hunt coordinator is and then try to get in contact with them. We'll just put it up. Likewise, nonprofit groups such as Capable Partners promised us that they're going to start putting DNR contact information, such as my phone number, in their newsletters, and they're going to do a better job of telling us who their hunt coordinators are. So I think that we can improve communications on both sides there. Licensing barriers, the system of having to use paper licenses is just simply going to go away under our new ELS system. We can select the disabled hunters, and they can go to an ELS station to buy their permit. However, if they are not capable of doing that or want to do it, the old way will still allow that too. They can send something in and we'll take care of them. Lack of understanding regarding disabled hunts. We will allow that. The criteria is that we want to make sure that it's a safe hunt, so we want to know what the hunt conditions are going to be, and we want to make sure that the organization has written permission from the landowner to the name of the sponsoring nonprofit. And then barriers for obtaining a permit to discharge a firearm from a motor vehicle. We are proposing one change to 97B111, special firearms hunting season for the physically disabled. We would insert a section that says, notwithstanding section 97B055 subdivision 3, the commissioner may authorize hunt participants to shoot from a stationary motor vehicle. This modification allows disabled hunters who are participating in a sponsored hunt to shoot from a standing motor vehicle, such as an ATV or pickup truck, without having to apply for a disability parking certificate or have a disability plate. So we think that that'll fix that, and that is, I believe, in our package that we're sending over, which hasn't been introduced yet, but we expect it to be part of the package. That's all I have on the disability hunting report.
Thank you. Representative Bill.
Well, my question is not on the organized hunts. How about people with temporary disabilities? Right now, as I recall, it requires a permanent disability. But how would you, and the reason I ask this is we've got a couple of instances where people have had accidents and are temporarily disabled and they want to go deer hunting. How could we, have you had any interest in that? And this one particular person that contacted me was the parents of a child, a youth hunter, that was temporarily disabled for a finite period of time. Have you had any interest in that? Has anyone called about that? Have you ever considered accommodating those folks for that finite period of time?
Mr. Penning.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, actually I have never been contacted on something like that, so we have not really put a lot of thought into it. However, when we do have these sponsored hunts, we let the sponsoring nonprofit make the determination of who is or is not disabled. And typically they have their own sets of criteria. For instance, capable partners criteria are quite strict. The Turkey Federation a little less so. But most of these people that are going out on disabled hunts are quite disabled people and permanently disabled.
Mr. Boggess.
Madam Chair and Representative Dill, just to follow through on that a little bit, what we are proposing in this bill could apply to that situation if they were in a special hunt. It wouldn't cover what I think maybe you were asking, which was just if they want to just go hunting. The only thing I'm aware of in existing statutes that allows for accommodations for a temporary disability is crossbow permit for temporary disability for bull hunting.
Are there further questions? If not, thank you for your testimony on this, and we will move on to the last one.
Thank you.
And before we do that, I would like to have the approval of the January 26th minutes. Representative Murdoch, have you read the minutes, and would you like to move the approval?
Yes, I have, Madam Chair, and I move for approval.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Mr. Rogerson.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, I'll go through this report fairly quickly. I'll just let people know that every year, you don't have this report in front of you, but every year since 1993, the department's done a report on the Game and Fish Fund that just summarizes the expenditures by division, by dedicated account, and if there's interest in seeing copies of this, it's on our website, or I can have printed copies made available. But just as a little bit of background on the Game and Fish Fund, for those who may not be familiar with it, it's a fund in the state treasury. It's primarily composed of hunting and fishing license fees and then federal excise taxes on hunting and fishing equipment that are apportioned back to the states based on the geographic area of the state and the number of licensed individuals who hunt and fish in those states. The reason for the report that's before you today goes back about 10 years or so, was when the issue first kind of surfaced of how the money in the fund gets divided up. It comes from both hunters and anglers, and it's spent for both fisheries and wildlife programs. It's always been managed as one fund. There is a lot of kind of overlap in some of the activities that we do for habitat that affect both fish and wildlife, but in the mid-1990s, there were two back-to-back winters in 95-96 and 96-97. Those were the last two really severe winters that we've had in the state, other than maybe the one we're in right now, we'll see. But they were severe enough that we're having major die-offs of deer in northern Minnesota, and there was extensive debate about whether or not we should be feeding deer. And one of those 2 years, the decision was made in the legislature that we should feed deer, and we did. And to do that, a loan was made from the regular Game and Fish Fund account to feed the deer, and it was to be paid back from a portion of deer licenses that were placed into a special deer feeding account. And the reason that loan was done was because there was a perception at the time in the fisheries community that wildlife expenditures were more than their fair share of revenues that were coming into the Game and Fish Fund. So that loan was authorized. It's still on the books. We're maybe bringing something forward. I haven't seen the final budget bill yet, but we may ask for forgiveness of that loan this year because of the issue that I'm talking to you today about. But that sort of was the first surfacing of the issue, but it had never been analyzed by the fiscal people because it had always been managed as one fund. So the Game and Fish Fund has citizen oversight committees. Actually, a couple of legislators were added to the Budget Oversight Committee in 2007. Representative Gill and Senator Chaudhry are the two legislators that are on the Budget Oversight Committee. But it's primarily a citizens committee that was formed in 1994, and it oversees the expenditures, and they comment back to the department and the legislature on if they feel that we've been spending the Game and Fish Fund in the way that the legislature intended and that the people who contribute to the fund would like to see. But that Budget Oversight Committee in the late 90s became interested in this issue as a result of the controversy over the deer feeding. And we did a preliminary analysis of expenditures and revenues in the late 1990s. I'll back up a second to page 2, which has the actual language that passed the legislature in 2007 that required this report. And it had a due date of November of 2008. But it required us to report to the Policy and Finance Committees on imbalances between hunting-related and fishing-related activities and expenditures, including allocation of the Game and Fish Fund receipts and expenditures for fiscal years 1989 to 2007. Well, we don't have good data going back to 1989, but we've included the preliminary analysis that was done in 1999 because that data does go back that far, and I think that was the reason that got written into law. And if you look at page, I'll skip forward a little bit in the interest of time here. We can go back if there are questions. But page 4 has a table and a chart that shows that old methodology. Mm-hmm. And what had been done back in the late 90s was to look at we could split out the revenues and attribute it to either, obviously if it's a fishing license, it's a fishing revenue. If it's a hunting license, it's a hunting revenue. If it's a sports license combination, then we have to allocate the revenue. If it's revenue from a WMA crop lease or timber sale, that goes to wildlife and so forth. The federal Dingo Johnson Wallop Bro money comes in from fisheries equipment, excise taxes on fisheries equipment, Pittman Robertson from wildlife. So those were all pretty easy to categorize for the revenue side. The expenditure side, in that preliminary analysis, all we had was data from the Division of Fish and Wildlife in the DNR. As you'll see for the more current information, a lot of other divisions also get Game and Fish dollars, including enforcement and ecological resources and even trails and waterways and so forth. So the more recent numbers will be a more comprehensive department-wide analysis. This table that goes, the table 1 at the top of page 4, goes back to the 88-89 biennium. You'll see revenues and expenditures for fisheries management, revenues and expenditures for wildlife management. The expenditure side is only within the Division of Fish and Wildlife. You can see that in 88-89, fisheries management activity was spending 48% of fisheries-related revenue, and wildlife was spending 51% of wildlife-related revenue. You can also see that there was some trend over the next 10 years pushing the fisheries expenditures of fisheries-related revenues up to the 63 to 65% range, and wildlife expenditures of wildlife-related revenue down to the 43 to 45% range. So it actually was kind of the opposite of what the perception was during the feeding debate, according to this analysis. But this wasn't a comprehensive analysis. And the chart at the bottom of page 4 just shows that that same thing graphically on the percent of revenues that were expended for fisheries and wildlife. So we go on to the more comprehensive and current analysis starting on page 5. And the Budget Oversight Committee had seen that preliminary analysis. There were all sorts of scenarios that you could pose. What if we include dedicated accounts? What if we don't include dedicated accounts? And I should just say that the Game and Fish Fund itself is a dedicated account, but within it are a number of sub-accounts that are also dedicated. So there's a duck stamp account, a pheasant stamp account, a trout and salmon account, a deer management account. And those accounts can only be spent for even more specific purposes. So, and then what if you include general fund, don't include general fund, and so forth. So in 2001, the Budget Oversight Committee actually formed an ad hoc group to work with DNR on a comprehensive analysis of this issue throughout the department. They came to agreement on a number of assumptions on how revenues and expenditures would be allocated throughout all the divisions in the department. And with that standard set of assumptions, now we can do the same analysis every year, and it's comparable from one year to the next. So since fiscal year 2000, we now have a new methodology that's comprehensive department-wide, and that we actually include each year. This sort of an analysis that shows expenditures by DNR unit, fisheries, wildlife, license center, ecological resources, enforcement, trails and waterways, lands, minerals, and operations for each year, and then we can update it each year to show how these percentages are changing. The findings, I won't go through a lot of the text, but look at page 6, and I apologize for the small type, especially on the footnotes. It made it all fit on one page, but you can see expenditures in the top rows there from fiscal year 2000 through the current biennium projected in their actual numbers up to 06, 07 projected for 08, 09. You can see that hunting and fishing expenditures are in those top two rows. The revenues are in the bottom two rows. So if we just maybe for the sake of example look at the projected FY 08-09 numbers, since that's the current biennium that we're in, there's projected hunting expenditures of $64 million, hunting related in all the divisions, of $64.378 million, and of fishing related expenditures, $85.5 million. Revenues in that same biennium, you drop down the next to the middle set of rows there, about $68.1 million on the hunting side, about $82.1 million on the fishing side. So to get to the imbalance, you go to that bottom set of rows, which is how much of the hunting revenue is being expended for the wildlife activity, and you can see for the most recent biennium it's 94.5%. And how much of the fishing revenue is being expended for the fisheries activity, you can see for the most current biennium it's projected at 104.1%. And the people think the target should be 100% every year. It really hasn't worked that way historically because of the cycle of fee increases, which have been on an average about every 6 years. So typically after a fee increase, the last general hunting and fishing fee increase we had was in 2001. Typically, we would underspend that revenue in the first few years of the subsequent years following the fee increase because of inflationary factors that tend to increase the cost of doing business, so that there would be an accumulating balance for a few years, and then as inflation starts to eat away at that, there would be a declining balance for a few years where we're actually spending more than the revenue that's coming in. And ultimately, the way it's gone historically, at least there would be another fee increase at some point down the road. So it isn't necessarily a one-to-one every year goal. you can see the revenues from fees at the bottom of the page 6 there. for fishing licenses and hunting licenses. There's other, as I said, other federal revenue that comes in. Moving on to page 7 is how do you fix this? And there's only four things that, because we're dealing with two ratios here, there's only four things that affect those. And it's the wildlife revenues or wildlife expenditures related to the hunting revenues and the fisheries expenditures related to the fishing revenues. So to give some examples of kind of the magnitude of where the imbalance is. Now, if you want to have an equal proportion of hunting expenditures to wildlife revenues as you have fisheries expenditures to fisheries revenues, if you move to page 8, there's four scenarios here that if you tried to fix the whole current imbalance with just one of those four potential strategies, just illustrates what you would need to do. So one way you could bring the wildlife-related expenditure proportion into line with the fisheries-related expenditure proportion is to increase wildlife-related expenditures. To solve the whole imbalance, just doing that would require an increase in wildlife-related expenditures of 12% or about $7.7 million a year. Similarly, you could decrease hunting-related revenue, so there's less revenue, then the current expenditure becomes a higher proportion. To do that, hunting revenues would need to be decreased by $7.1 million a year. Either of those, I think it's pretty clear, would not be real good for the balance in the Game and Fish Fund. And I would just point out the Game and Fish Fund balance, since it's been 8 years now since we had a general fee increase, its balance is projected to stay solvent at current levels of expenditure through the 10 and 11 biennium, but then to go into the red, which it can't do in the following biennium. So I'll try to move it along here quickly, but you could also decrease fisheries-related expenditures. If we cut fisheries by $9.2 million, we could balance it that way, or increase fisheries revenue by $9.5 million. Obviously, these are difficult things if any one of them was done by itself. At the bottom of page 8 is the recommendation of the Budget Oversight Committee. They did not want to see cuts to programs. They did want to see fee increases and using those increases to offset the imbalance. They also wanted to see broader funding from other sources, such as the General Fund for Fisheries Management. And maybe with that, I'll just, I don't want to skip over the recommendations, but just call your attention to page 11, where there's a couple of pie charts. And if you see the wildlife management, kind of what we call the funding portfolio on the right, you can see that Game and Fish Fund and Game and Fish Dedicated are all still Game and Fish Fund, and then the heritage enhancements from in lieu of tax on lottery tickets, which also is an account in the Game and Fish Fund. But you can see that the wildlife activity has much more bonding, rim, and even general fund at that time than what the fisheries management activity does. Now, we've since shifted general fund from wildlife to fisheries and shifted Game and Fish Fund from fisheries to wildlife to address this imbalance somewhat. And looking for the chart at the top of page 7 shows where this more recent imbalance has been. You can see it was widening through 06-07. We were able to narrow it in 08-09, but you can see it starting to widen back again in projected fiscal year 10 and 11, just because of some declining revenue that we're projecting based on the new conservation angling license, some loss of revenue from portable shelter licensing that wasn't made up. There was an attempt to make it up, but it wasn't made up. Actually, the deer simplification that we did last year with the legislature reduced wildlife revenue, which had the effect of helping to close this gap. But the other projected loss of revenue is causing it to widen back up. Quickly on recommendations, which start on the bottom of page 9, short term, we think that this allocation ratio should continue to be a factor that's used when decisions are being made on funding priorities. or when realigning programs, that when there are new funding opportunities, initiatives, or whatever, which climate is not very good for right now, but when those are available, that that this imbalance be considered as those are done. And we did do some of that last biennium, where we did ask for some wildlife initiatives, but not new fisheries initiatives. Efficiency increase and license structure modification. At some point, we're going to have to get into a serious discussion of that. We don't think, with both the economic climate we're in right now and the passage of the new outdoor heritage constitutional amendment, that that it's the right time this biennium. But after one more biennium, something's going to have to change with the Game and Fish Fund, because it, by law, cannot go into the red. And then the last short-term strategy is to forgive the debt to the Game and Fish Fund from the deer feeding loan that I talked about earlier in the presentation. Longer term, continue to monitor and analyze the ratios. We intend to continue to put them in the annual Game and Fish Fund report. The Budget Oversight Committee should annually discuss these allocations as they review the Game and Fish Fund. How the two activities are funded in terms of general fund bonding, Game and Fish Fund, REM, and other funds should be looked at as part of this. The Game and Fish Fund has to maintain an adequate balance. Finally, I'd just like to make a few kind of closing comments, if I have a minute. there will never be an equal balance because of the differences in how revenues come in and how expenditures are made and funded. But we need a balance over time that's acceptable to those that are contributing these fees, and right now it's not acceptable to those people. We also need to recognize that this analysis separates fishing revenue, but in reality there's overlap between those, as I said earlier. So we think the department and the legislature and the Budget Oversight Committee need to work together to come to an acceptable resolution of this imbalance issue over the long term. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Bogus. Any questions? Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just trying to be brief with my question and as brief as you can with the answer. Going back to the you were talking about the fund, and I just wanted to explore briefly the algorithm that you use when you said it wasn't the fund. I can't remember your words, but you talked about inflation impacting the outcome of your calculations. And could you just speak to that briefly? I'm curious as to what inflation does have to do with it.
Madam Chair and Representative Purcell, I think the point I was making that you're referencing was that we're not necessarily striving for 100%, because in early years after a fee increase, both activities might be spending 90% of the revenue because we're building a balance to hedge against future inflation. If a lot of our work is very labor intensive, and just having staff, typically staff vehicles, fuel, all of that, to do the same amount of work, 4 years from now, it's going to cost more money than it costs today, because the cost of salaries and supplies and so forth has gone up. So just to maintain a stable delivery of service, we need to plan for some inflationary pressure. So I was just making the point that there isn't necessarily a magic target of 100% each year, that it may be 90% in the early years, it may be 105% in the later years before another fee increase comes in, just because of those inflationary forces maintaining a level of delivery of service.
Representative, real
quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And you answered that. Thank you. It does sound like it's probably prudent to figure inflation into our sustainable management activities. Thank you.
If there are no further questions or comments, the meeting is adjourned.